we'll wait for the courtroom to clear for a moment, if we may, Mr. Alexander. Thank you, Mr. Alexander. I think we can proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. Dan Alexander for Ronnie Evans. May it please the court. Your Honors, in granting summary judgment to the defendants, the trial court had to make key factual rulings against Ronnie Evans, rulings that should have been made by a jury under this very court's precedent. I'll start with the RICO standing issue, Your Honors. Under this court's cases, Evans needed only to show some evidence of RICO injury to business or property. This injury requirement, this court has held, should be construed broadly. That would be Life of Mid-America insurance case that I cited in my brief. This court has also held in the Israel travel case that the court will look to proximate cause type issues. In other words, how direct and foreseeable were the injuries the plaintiff suffered, and were there RICO acts that caused the injury? Here, Your Honors, Mr. Evans was subject to an extensive campaign of terror and harassment after Mr. Evans witnessed these two police officers strangle his cousin to death and became the key witness in the case against the city of Chicago for that killing of his cousin. And the act, there's all kinds of evidence in the record of literally hundreds of harassing type acts by these officers against Mr. Evans. And it is these very acts that caused the RICO injuries in this case. In other words, when the police officers beat someone and threaten someone and arrest someone and lock them up, for instance, the disorderly conduct charge where the two officers didn't show up in court, they know that someone is going to be incarcerated and lose income and also incur attorney's fees. I mean, that's a given. That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. And on that, but Mr. Evans did have a long, steady work background a couple of years prior to being arrested in this case, and he was actively looking for work at the time of the injury. And since his release, Your Honor, he's worked steadily. Practically hasn't missed a day of work since he got out. That's absolutely correct, Your Honor. It's undisputed that for 3 years he did not find work, but he was actively seeking work at the time of his arrest. And the case law is very, very clear on this, Your Honor, that there's no job required at the time of injury. We only need some basis for a jury to assess damages. And the basis here clearly is both Mr. Evans' track record going back in time, admittedly 3 years, of having a very steady work record, his education, and the fact that he's worked steadily since he got out of jail. Well, Your Honor, I won't argue with the court. I respectfully disagree, and I believe that if the court looks at the case law on this subject, for example, the Seventh Circuit said in Reed versus Union that you only need some evidence to get income instruction, and also we have another case here that there only has to be some basis. In fact, Illinois law, Doe v. Roe, this court's case, says you look to Illinois state law on these property issues. And under Illinois law, right on point, there's cases that say there's no job required at the time of the injury, period. No job required. There only has to be some basis for the jury to assess damages. Clearly, if he's worked every day since he got out of jail, there's a basis to assess damages. So I would respectfully disagree that it's wholly speculative. What we need here is some rational basis to assess damages, and clearly we have that here because he's worked steadily since he got out of jail, and he was actively seeking work at the time he was arrested, Your Honor. In addition to the income, though, we have the attorney fee issue. And this in particular, this is an extreme reading of the facts of the case for the movement in the summary judgment case, what the trial court did here. Here we've got a man who incurred $20,000 in attorney's fees for all, not just the two cases that he eventually was convicted on, but all these cases, all four cases, and he paid $20,000 in attorney's fees. And he's got an affidavit that says that he would have paid a lot less if he had less than four cases.
Actually, he didn't pay any of the attorney's fees. His aunt paid $10,000 and the remaining
He paid the $10,000 through his aunt. His aunt loaned him the money, so he owes that money, Your Honor. There was never any dispute in the lower court that these were his attorney's fees that he incurred. He incurred a debt. He borrowed $10,000 and paid the $10,000 to attorney Brandstrader, and the $10,000 he agreed to pay me he has not yet paid, but he has a debt for that also. So, you know, he clearly incurred attorney's fees in this case. And what the court did is it took a very strained reading of the record to try to get around that, saying, well, attorney Brandstrader said if he would only would have been one case, there would have been less attorney's fees. Well, Mr. Evans has an affidavit that says he would have paid less fees if there had only been three cases. I mean, clearly that's common sense. And if you look at the record, almost all of the work that was done in the state court revolved around these harassment and this extortion and witness tampering and RICO type predicate act. That's where all the work went. If you look at the transcripts, Your Honor, all the court appearances where there were live witnesses put on were about these harassing incidents. In fact, I did it myself. I put on witness after witness in the state court proceeding over a course of many months trying to show this pattern of harassment. And the only ruling, the state eventually withdrew on that case. The only ruling was where the trial court denied the state's motion for a directed verdict, meaning that we had sustained our burden, but then after that the state withdrew the case. So there was no finding on the record other than the fact that we had sustained our burden. But my point is this, that the work done in this case revolved around the RICO predicate acts in this case. And that's what Mr. Evans incurred the debt for the attorney's fees for. That clearly under the case law is a RICO injury, is an injury to business or property. What the city argues, it seems to me, from rereading their brief to prepare for this, is that, you know, because Mr. Evans wasn't a corporation or something, this doesn't count. You can't have business or property injury. This not their exact words, but this is the reading I got out of it. But that's not the law, Your Honor. I mean, this certainly would be a business or property injury under the case law that I cited in my brief. I also want to talk about the intentional infliction of emotional distress and First Amendment cases, unless the court has more questions on the RICO standing issue. Again, we filed suit within 1 year of the termination of the criminal proceedings in this case. Both of these counts, the IIED, as we like to abbreviate it, and the First Amendment case, target the overall conduct associated with these prosecutions. And that's why it's that very reason that the district court precedent that we cited in our brief has consistently held that the statute of limitations does not begin until the termination of the criminal proceedings when you target the same type of conduct that sort of would be attacked in a malicious prosecution case. No, Your Honor, it was 2000, I believe March of 2000. So we filed within 1 year of the termination of the criminal, with the exception of, I'm not talking now about the disorderly conduct arrest by the defendants, but the bulk of the criminal prosecutions were terminated, I believe it was March of 2000. So we did file suit within 1 year of that, following district court precedent, which I've cited, you know, three or four cases in my brief, and granted, we didn't have a Seventh Circuit case right on point on that issue, but it's been longstanding district court precedent, and for good reason, that when you target the same type of conduct that a malicious prosecution case would target, the claim does not begin, the clock does not begin to tick until the criminal prosecution is ended. That's why we believe that the district court erred. In fact, the district court came to that same conclusion in one or two of its earlier opinions before it granted summary judgment. They're in our short appendix, of course, in the brief. So the district court cited the same precedent that we're citing, saying that our case was not time-barred. And we believe that, that was the correct ruling by the trial court. In addition, both claims involved a continuing tort, Your Honor, a repeated course of tortious conduct. And what we have here is essentially these officers, once Mr. Evans came out and went on the news and said, I saw these cops strangle my cousin, they began this incredible terror campaign against Ronnie Evans. And it didn't stop really at any time. It even went through filing the lawsuit. What happened was they simply shifted their efforts from the street to the courtroom after they finally arrested Mr. Evans and got him locked up. After beating him, threatening him, strip searching him in public, after all of those things did not shut Mr. Evans up, they started... Yes, Your Honor. They pulled him out of his house and in front of multiple neighbors of his, including females, made him take off all of his clothes, made him bend over and shined a flashlight up his anus, and then they drove off laughing at him. It's all in the brief and it's all in the record, and there's plenty of evidence to support it, Your Honor. And what happened was once Mr. Evans got locked up, the tortious conduct didn't stop. It just shifted to the courtroom. It didn't make any sense for them to keep their street battle going on against Mr. Evans. So what they did was they falsified police reports. They lied in court. They did everything they could in court against Mr. Evans, and they were successful to a large extent. Then what happened was when Mr. Evans finally got out of jail after 28 months in jail, they shifted their tactics right back to the street. Now, Mr. Evans was smart enough to stay out of his old neighborhood, and I guarantee you he did. I mean, he basically said he was living like Osama bin Laden, hiding all the time, and he stayed out of his neighborhood, but he had contact with people in his old neighborhood. They would call him, they would talk to him, and the same officers involved in this terror campaign were still coming back to his house. And we have an affidavit from Jerome Hudson that these officers came back and were asking about Ronnie, saying they were going to get him. This conduct continued after the lawsuit was filed. So we have a continuing course of tortious conduct here, and that is another reason why the statute of limitations, we didn't violate the statute of limitations on the IIED in the First Amendment case. I'm cutting into my cherished rebuttal time, so if there's no further questions, thank you.
Yes, exactly. Thank you. May it please the court. In this case, Mr. Evans complains about a pattern of police harassment that ended in 1997 and also about a series of prosecutions that culminated in his conviction, which is still outstanding today in the year 2000. This morning, I will explain that Evans's first set of claims, those based on the extrajudicial harassment in 1997, are barred by the applicable statutes of limitations. I will also explain that his other claims, those based on the prosecutions, are barred by his inability to show that the criminal proceedings terminated in his favor. On Evans's RICO claim, we explain in our brief that all of the pecuniary losses he asserts as a basis for RICO standing stem from his valid and still outstanding drug convictions. These injuries, therefore, cannot be treated as legally cognizable. On the specifics of the evidence, we will rest on our brief. On the First Amendment claim, Evans seeks two types of damages, and these need to be addressed separately. He first claims damages stemming from what I call the extrajudicial harassment. That's the alleged strip searches and beatings. And although we agree that much of this misconduct would, if proven, establish a First Amendment violation, all of the extrajudicial conduct occurred in 1997. After that time, Evans did not see any of these officers outside of a courtroom. But he did not file suit until late in the year 2000, and accordingly, his First Amendment claim to damages stemming from the extrajudicial harassment is barred by the two-year statute of limitations for Section 1983 claims. Evans's First Amendment claim also seeks damages stemming from the criminal prosecution, but because he cannot show that any of the criminal proceedings terminated in his favor, this claim is not legally cognizable. On his state law claim, alleging intentional infliction of emotional distress, Evans again seeks two types of damages, and these again need to be addressed separately. His claim to damages stemming from the extrajudicial harassment in 1997 is time barred by the one-year statute of limitations for Illinois tort claims against municipal employees. And his claim to damages stemming from the prosecutions is without merit, both because the bringing of a valid criminal prosecution is neither extreme nor outrageous under Illinois law, and because in Illinois, an IIED claim arising out of an allegedly wrongful prosecution requires favorable termination, and he cannot show favorable termination. Unless the court has questions, for all of these reasons, we respectfully request that this court affirm the district court's grant of summary judgment for the officers.
Thank you. closely familiar with some of the terminology.
Sure.
In Chicago for terminating criminal proceedings, we don't use that same terminology in Wisconsin. The cases that were dismissed, the charges that were dismissed or otherwise dropped, were dropped or dismissed not on the merits?
There are four charges. Two, the June and July charges, resulted in valid convictions that stand today. Then there is also the violation of probation charge, which resulted in probation terminated unsatisfactorily. And I guess I'd preface my remarks on that charge by pointing out that it's really a red herring, because there's no evidence of any damages stemming from that charge. He spent the 2+ years in jail pursuant to the June and July drug convictions, not on the violation of probation. But whatever the PTU means, it does not mean that this charge was terminated in his favor. In fact, I mean, he agrees that he violated his probation. He was convicted of drug charges while on probation. In this case, I mean, the prosecutor, the evidence showed, made the decision not to pursue that charge because it was moot, because he had served all the time he could serve for the violation of probation on the June and July drug charges.
What about the legal effect of probation that's terminated unsatisfactorily?
It's not terminated in his favor, and that's what matters for Heck versus Humphrey, is that he does not have a termination in his favor on that charge, and Heck holds that compensable injury cannot flow from a valid conviction.
Is that a judicial determination or an administrative determination by correction?
I'm afraid I don't know. I could certainly investigate that, and if it would be helpful, I could submit later. The May 12th charge, that was null prost pursuant to a plea agreement. Essentially, yes. Yes. If that answers your question. Yes, yes. And there's some dispute, I guess, about the plea agreement. What the evidence showed is that the prosecutor dismissed that charge only after Evans pled guilty to the June charge. The testimony of both the prosecutor and Mr. Evans's attorney at the time was that the prosecutor agreed to null prost that charge only if Mr. Evans would plead to the June charge. Mr. Evans says he didn't know anything about that agreement, but what the district court correctly discerned is that his testimony does not rebut the fact that both the prosecutor and his attorney testified that they had entered into such an agreement. What the state court record shows is that only after Mr. Evans pled guilty to the June 8th charge did the prosecutor null prost the May charge. There's no record beyond that. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, some of this reminds me of trying to link Saddam Hussein to 9/11. If they think if they keep saying it over and over and over, people are going to believe it, and maybe that'll work. A couple of things. They keep saying that Mr. Evans served all, that he had no damages because all the time he served in jail, 28 months, was related to the charge that he pled guilty to and the one he was convicted of. That is simply not true. The record is very clear. It's in our brief. It's in our statement of fact that he would have gotten 18 months on the charge that he was convicted of and pled guilty to, 18 months. He served 28 months in jail, so there's 10 months there where he definitely would not have been incarcerated except for the charges that were resolved in his favor or that were certainly not resolved against him. Now, we didn't appeal that issue whether these two charges were resolved in his favor, but they were. The fact is we didn't have enough evidence under this court's law. The affidavit of the person involved is insufficient. So I may disagree with that, but that's the law of the Seventh Circuit. But Mr. Evans clearly, the prosecutor told him and told his lawyer he was not going to proceed on the May 12th charges because he didn't think it was a good case. There's absolutely nothing on the state court record whatsoever to show that this was part of any plea agreement. There's nothing in the record. And all the judge would have had to do is say that. The prosecutor could have said that. He could have said, "Judge, we're doing this as part of a plea agreement." The court could have said that. There's not a word in the transcript. And all we have is Mr. Evans's word against a disgruntled former lawyer and the assistant state's attorney. And under the law of this circuit, we lose on that. I'm sorry, Your Honor? Your Honor, we're not disputing that, and we're not... Not that I'm aware of. Not yet. Not that I'm aware of. Well, all I'm saying, Your Honor, is we strongly believe that they're wrong, that they had motivations to lie, and that Mr. Evans... Well, without a doubt. I mean, just even in the... A lot of this is... That's my opinion, Your Honor, and as far as what's in the record, the only thing really that's in the record that I could argue is that the former attorney billed Mr. Evans for $3,500, which he was not paid for. Other than that, there's things I'd love to tell the court, but they're not in the record, so I'm not, and I can't do that. But yes, he's a disgruntled man, and... I'm sorry, Your Honor? That's my opinion, sir. That's my opinion. But that's not important here, really. The point is, because we conceded that point, because the Seventh Circuit law said an affidavit by the person is not enough. So we conceded that point. It doesn't matter, because there were two cases that were not resolved against Mr. Evans. That's the point I want to make to this court, and they keep saying they were resolved against him. The PTU, by the way, Your Honor, there's a range of statutory options that a criminal court judge can use to terminate probation. PTU is only one of them. One of them is probation terminated satisfactorily, one is probation terminated unsatisfactorily. This has nothing to do with a criminal charge of violating probation. The state withdrew that charge. After I spent months and months putting on witnesses about all these harassing incidents, the state made a directed verdict motion saying we hadn't sustained our burden. The court denied it. They withdrew the charge. So there's never been a finding that Mr. Evans violated probation. So that's a complete red herring, but it's something they keep repeating over and over and over, that he agreed he violated his probation. Simply not true. And that he served all his time, and all the time he served was due to his convictions. Simply not true. And the evidence is right there in the record, in the briefs, and in the fact statements, Your Honors. And see if I had anything else. Well, I can see the amber light is coming on anyway. And so I'm just going to ask this court, this is a man who stood up, he saw his cousin killed, the taxpayers ended up paying $500,000 on this case, the police officers were promoted, and my client was strip-searched, beaten, and sent to jail for 28 months. All he's asking for is his day in court, and I think he deserves it, and I'm asking this court to give it to him. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Alexander. Thank you, Mr. Alexander. Thank you for your help. And the case will be taken under advice. The sixth case this morning is number 04.